From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I actually chose the name Emmanuel Goldstein back in 1984, or maybe a little bit before 1984. I was being prosecuted by the federal government back then for computer hacking. And Emmanuel Goldstein, of course, is a character in 1984. He's the leader of the underground. It's rather ironic now that they look at me as the leader of the underground.
Hollywood versus Hacker Round 1 is over. We'll talk to Emmanuel Goldstein. And part two of our look at Turkey, how it's trying to rewrite the Armenian Genocide. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Iraq says it will not accept the new United Nations arms inspection team established under a Security Council resolution last December. Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz told reporters and members of parliament in Baghdad that Iraq does not accept Security Council Resolution 1284 calling for UN weapons inspectors to return to Baghdad. The previous mission, UNSCUM, was exposed to have in its ranks American spies, as Iraq had long contended. Resolution 1284 sets up a new arms inspection body called the United Nations Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission to replace UNSCUM. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says it's suspending operations in West Timor after three of its workers were severely injured in an attack by Indonesian militias. The UNHCR said the attack with sticks and machetes came as the workers were distributing plastic sheeting to East Timorese refugees. The refugee agency said the aid workers had to receive hospital treatment for severe head and body injuries. Fernando Del Mundo, a spokesman at the Geneva headquarters of the UNHCR, said conditions have been worsening for a month in West Timor, where aid workers have been caring for refugees and continuing to organize their return to East Timor. UNHCR operations will be suspended indefinitely while a senior official of the agency goes to Kupang, the capital of West Timor, to investigate the attack with Indonesian officials. The agency is also suspending visits to the camps by specialists checking on water, health, and sanitation services. Spokespeople said they were not sure what would happen to food distributions. Since the vote on self-determination last August, more than 100,000 Timorese who were driven out of East Timor into West Timor by the Indonesian militias and military remain held in West Timor. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that Senate Commerce Committee Chair John McCain plans to summon top executives of Ford Motor Company and Bridgestone Firestone to testify about their handling of the massive tire recall that has roiled both companies. The Arizona Republican plans to invite Ford Chief Executive Jacques Nasser, Bridgestone Firestone Executive Vice President John Lamp, officials with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and consumer advocates to a September 6th hearing. The hearing will be the first chance for lawmakers to question executives and federal officials on the Bridgestone Firestone recall, which included 6.5 million tires mounted on Ford's popular Explorer sport utility vehicles. Bridgestone Firestone announced the recall earlier this month after widespread publicity of fatal accidents reportedly linked to treads peeling off the tires. Washington Post is reporting that the Republican National Committee, in a last-minute reversal last night, withdrew a television ad that harshly attacked Vice President Al Gore. The Post said the RNC bowed to objections from the campaign of George W. Bush and his advisors when it decided to yank the ad after it had been delivered to 350 TV stations. It said the ad shows a stammering Gore maintaining that President Clinton has never told a lie, although the ad seems to suggest that Gore is deliberately overlooking Clinton's repeated statements denying his sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky. The footage in the ad actually came from a Gore interview conducted in 1994, well before the president had even met Lewinsky. The tagline, "Al Gore will say anything to get elected," is a version of the refrain used often by the Bush campaign. Third-party presidential candidates may trail in the polls, but a majority of Americans say they should be allowed to participate in televised debates. This according to a recent nationwide poll. A Zogby America survey of likely voters showed that Green Party presidential nominee Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan one of two rivals for the Reform Party nod, should be allowed to debate alongside the Republican and Democratic candidates despite low poll numbers. The Commission on Presidential Debates requires a nominee to have an average of 15% support in five major polls in order to participate in televised debates. More than half the respondents said Nader should be in the debate. Nader and Buchanan have filed a lawsuit to get into the debates. The first one is scheduled for October 3rd in Boston. Jesse Jackson Jr., the congressmember from Illinois, has also introduced a resolution into Congress calling for a lowering of the bar that would allow in third-party candidates into the debate. Mexican President-elect Vicente Fox is using a two-day visit to the United States to outline his vision for a freer flow of people and goods across the border. Fox's proposal for an eventual opening of borders with the U.S. has been greeted with skepticism by U.S. business and labor groups, but President Clinton said yesterday he wants to hear more before making a judgment.
Hey, pal, how do I get to town from here? He said, we'll just take a right where they're gonna build that new shopping mall. Go straight past where they're gonna put in the freeway. And take a left at what's gonna be the new sports center. And keep going till you hit the place where they're thinking of building that drive-in bank. You can't miss it. And I said, this must be the place.
Big Science, Laurie Anderson here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Last week, a federal judge in New York permanently barred hacker journalist Emmanuel Goldstein from posting or linking to a software code that unlocks the copy protection encryption of DVD movie discs. Goldstein is publisher of 2600, a hacker publication, and he's also host of Off the Hook on Pacifica Station here at WBAI in New York. He was sued by the Motion Picture Association of America. His attorneys argued that computer code was a protected form of speech under the First Amendment. Judge Lewis Kaplan called the defense baseless. A group of European teenagers created the Decode Content Scrambling System, or DECSS, to allow DVDs to be played by computers using the Linux operating system. Goldstein was targeted by the movie industry for publicizing DECSS on the www.2600.org website and linking to sites that allowed the software to be downloaded. I caught up with him this week after his show, Off the Hook.
Right now, it's 8 o'clock here in WBAI in New York, and that means it's time for Off the Hook. And a very good evening to everybody. It's been one heck of a week here. How am I doing? I'm doing okay. I'm doing fine. yes, it's just been one of those weeks, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you have a bit of a cold at one point, you lose a multi-million-dollar lawsuit at the other point. It's just one of those things. But yeah, man.
The lows and the lows.
Yeah, that's something. I'm sure a lot of people listening right now have heard the news before we even have to tell them the news. In fact, I'm sure a lot of people on their way to that other radio station that get snagged by us on the way and they just want to find out who these weird people are talking. I'm sure you already heard the news too without even knowing what it's all about.
But yes, the DVD lawsuit, the ECSS lawsuit, is over, and we lost. Well, of course, none of this really surprises us because we expected this to happen. What surprised me more than anything was just the adamant hostility expressed by the judge. I mean, wow. Did you read the thing, Isaac?
People have thrown bits and pieces of it at me.
You didn't actually read it, though. You got to read through this.
I have to.
It's up on the website. Go to the website. Go to the website.
Okay.
Go on. Get out of here. Go to the website and check out the PDF file we have, right? Actually, if anybody has one of these translation tools...
Your reaction to the judge's ruling.
Well, I wasn't exactly surprised. I was a bit put off by his hostility. That really was unexpected as far as the veracity of his statements.
Explain.
Well, he seemed to judge a lot of his decision based on who we were and what we stand for. The explanation that we are acting as journalists seemed to go right over his head. He seemed to want to consider us as some kind of pirate. He was amazed that we actually would have a copyright on our own magazine because of the kinds of articles we print, as if that has anything to do with what publishing is all about. We publish information. The fact that he doesn't like the information that we publish should not have a bearing in how the law applies to us. But basically, he said that the intent was there to break the law and to distribute things that we weren't supposed to distribute. And what we did was we reported on a story and we showed people what we were reporting on, which was the source code that was out there for at least a month before we reported it. So to say that we're responsible for spreading it around it tells me that he really just either doesn't know the case or doesn't want to know the case.
For listeners who are just hearing about this case for the first time, we interviewed you during the trial, and now the judge has rendered his verdict. Explain what's at issue here, what it is that you publish, what the source code is.
Well, basically what's at issue here is a consumer's right to use technology the way he or she wants to use it. For instance, if you buy a CD, can you play that CD in your house or can you only play that CD in your car? Can you play a CD that you buy in England or can you only listen to American music? These are the kinds of things that, while not in place yet, are very, very close to being put in place, and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act makes it all legal, and it makes it illegal to try and get around that. And that's really all that the ECSS does, is try and get around some ridiculous restrictions that, in this particular case, made it illegal to try and watch a DVD on a Linux computer.
Explain what a Linux computer is.
Well, basically you have Microsoft and you have Macintosh, and those are the two operating systems you're supposed to use. But if you step outside the boundary and use something else, such as Linux or NetBSD or FreeBSD or any of the other operating systems that are being developed, and who knows how many more will be developed down the road, well, they want to say that you're not able, you're not allowed to look at a DVD on those platforms. You have to use the approved operating systems. And it really, it's something that's never been done before, where you have technology, but you can only play it on certain approved corporate platforms. When CDs came out, there was nobody there to say, well, you can only listen to a CD if you buy a Magnavox or a Sony machine or a Panasonic. You can't develop your own CD player. When records were out, anybody who could develop a phonograph could listen to a record. There was no restriction as to where you could listen to it or how you could listen to it or how many times you could listen to it. That's all changing, and that's what the DMCA is all about. And by trying to figure out ways around this, we are breaking the law, and that's what's frightening.
Emmanuel Goldstein, didn't the judge say that this source code was actually first developed not for Linux but for a Windows platform?
It was developed on a Windows platform because there were certain technical things that the Linux platform did not support yet. And so what they were doing was they were developing a Linux tool on another platform, a Windows platform. This is done all the time. You develop a tool on a different platform, then you port it over to the platform that you want to use it on. There's nothing at all suspicious about that. It's a simple matter of figuring out how the technology works and using the tools that you have at the moment to develop that.
What's the argument of the Motion Picture Association of America, which sued you?
They basically want to have complete control over every copyrighted work that they put out. And it doesn't just mean control over who copies it, or you know, how they will hold the copyright and prevent people from making illegal copies. They want to control access as well. They want to say, well, only these kinds of people can look at our material. Only people who buy this kind of hardware will be allowed to look at our material, and only under certain circumstances. They'll only be able to, you know, to watch it this many times. They won't be able to make fair use out of it, meaning they won't be able to take excerpts of it and use it for something else, such as a movie review or a class project. That just goes right out the window. So basically what they want to do is...
How does it limit that?
Because you technically cannot do it. The way the DVD is made, you cannot make a copy to another medium. And the judge's response to this was, well, go out and get a videotape. You can do it that way. And that just goes to show how little he knows about fair use, in that he wants you to go back to a primitive technology and grab your material off of there, because the new technology won't allow you to do it. And that shows right there that there is no provision for fair use in the new technology. And that doesn't even enter into the fact that there are many things on a DVD that are not included on a videotape. And I guess we just have no access to that at all.
So where do you go from here? Which court is this that you lost in?
This was federal court in New York that we lost in. We're now going to the appellate court. And we expect to make it all the way to the Supreme Court, because whoever loses in the appellate court is no doubt going to appeal. It's an incredible waste of resources, because the MPAA has already spent, they say, $4 million in their legal cost, and they want us to pay all their expenses, which is insane, because we don't play this kind of game. We're not in the corporate world in the sense that, you know, we fly first class and, you know, have shrimp for dinner and that kind of thing. These people are constantly, like, wasting money and time with these ridiculous lawsuits. And in this case, they won because the court happens to be in the same, I guess they think the same way as these corporate monsters do. And that's how I think of them, because they want to control everything that we do regarding DVDs, regarding CDs, regarding technology. And it's a really frightening thing. It's something that needs to be challenged. And fortunately, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has been there for us to challenge this and to bring this all the way to the Supreme Court. But at what a cost. It's simply unbelievable how much in time and effort this is costing.
You were at the protests in Philadelphia at the Republican National Convention. How does the source code to look at DVD movies tie into this anti-globalization protests that first really surged up in Seattle?
Well, I think what you're really starting to see now is mass awareness of just how bad things are getting. Because you have all this conglomeration, you have all these mergers, you have all these companies that are all running the media, and you can only get a certain amount of information out of them. They will only tell you a certain amount of things. These are the same companies that are suing us. These are the same companies that want to control DVDs, that want to control technology, that want to control how you access things. And they're also the ones that report the story. So how fair can that possibly be? The reason why you didn't see what really happened in Philadelphia, unless you were listening to Pacifica or taking part in the IMC, the reason why is because the corporate media doesn't want you to know. And it's very easy to control things when you have a monopoly. And that is what people are seeing now. They realize that every aspect of their lives, everything they do, is being controlled by the same people. And they're getting just a bit fed up with that. And when you see how it's dealt with, how one hand washes the other, how the police come in and arrest people who are just standing talking on cell phones, and the courts back up $500,000 in bail for these people, when they see how it all works together as one functioning machine, they realize just how broken that machine really is.
So the Electronic Frontier Foundation and Martin Garbus?
Yeah, Martin Garbus is an amazing lawyer that the EFF was able to get to represent our case. He's represented people such as Lenny Bruce and Spike Lee. And it's a real honor to be with somebody like that, who has such a keen awareness of what the First Amendment, what fair use is about. It's frustrating to see those arguments fall on deaf ears.
What do you think positive has been accomplished out of this lawsuit? I mean, you've lost so far.
Yeah, we've lost, but we've gained in many ways. We've brought together people that were not together before. The computer world, activists all over the place, we were kind of all fighting our own little battles. Now we're united. We're fighting one battle. And I've met so many people as a result of this that really know what's going on, that are working towards very positive things. And I think we're going to come out stronger as a result of this. I've noticed it in the hacker world that every time they try and clamp down on people, that we wind up being stronger because we fight back, because we speak up, because we won't be silenced. And now we have a whole lot of people that feel that way. I really am looking forward to seeing what comes out of that.
Your name, Emmanuel Goldstein, explain how you chose it.
Well, it seemed appropriate enough. I actually chose the name Emmanuel Goldstein back in 1984, or maybe a little bit before 1984. I was being prosecuted by the federal government back then for computer hacking. And Emmanuel Goldstein, of course, is a character in 1984. He's the leader of the underground. It's rather ironic now that they look at me as the leader of the underground. Corporate America looks at me that way. And it's frightening to realize how little they really do know. And hopefully the book won't, hopefully the real life won't turn out like the book did, where Emmanuel Goldstein turned out to be a figment of the imagination of the government. But we'll see.
If people want to get in touch with you, where can they call or go on the web?
Our website is www.2600.com, and we always have updates there as to what's going on, and hopefully they won't take us down.
You've been listening to Emmanuel Goldstein here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday on the program, we looked at how the Microsoft Corporation is under fire because its Encarta Encyclopedia calls the death of at least 600,000 Armenians during the last days of the Ottoman Empire the first genocide of the 20th century. As we said on the show yesterday, this is certainly not a radical assertion. Most historians agree with that characterization. But after the Turkish government objected, Microsoft's Encarta reportedly told several of its authors to consider the so-called other side of the story. The authors say they were told by Microsoft that if they did not agree to certain revisions, the company would publish it with Microsoft's revisions and without their names. Well, Microsoft's Encarta editor Gary Ault did come on the show yesterday, but only on the condition that he not be on with other guests like Ronald Suny, who joined us yesterday and joins us again today, professor of political science at the University of Chicago, who authored the piece for Encarta on the Armenian genocide. Just a reprise of what Gary Ault said yesterday, the Microsoft Encarta editor. He talked about the process that the encyclopedia's editors went through when they got a letter from the Turkish ambassador to the United States calling into question the Armenian genocide. We're just going to replay a bit of what Gary Ault had to say after they started to do research on that question following the letter.
A researcher went to the University of Washington libraries, looked up a lot of primary source documents, went out on the internet and did searches. But most importantly, she contacted current scholars. In fact, Dr. Suny was one of the people that she talked to during the course of putting together the research. And I had specifically asked her to try and contact some of the people who had signed this 1985 petition so that we would have that perspective as well. When I got the research report and went through it, it seemed to me that there was a legitimate controversy in the academic community over not over the facts of what had happened. Nobody is denying that hundreds of thousands or upwards of a million Armenians were killed during this period, and no one's denying that the Ottoman army was responsible. But what seemed to be a question was whether this was a centrally planned genocide. So based on the research that I had in front of me, I made a decision that, yes, this looks like there is a legitimate scholarly debate on this issue, and that in the interest of objectivity and fairness, we should recognize that in our coverage. This is what we do. We try to be balanced. We're not going to put in any crap.
That is what Gary Ault had to say yesterday on Democracy Now!, Microsoft's Encarta Encyclopedia editor. Ronald Suny is on with us now, the professor of political science who wrote the piece that, for a few years at least, was not questioned in Encarta until the Turkish ambassador wrote the letter to Encarta complaining. Ronald Suny, your response about what Gary Ault calls a legitimate debate on the issue of the genocide.
Well, those remarks that it was a legitimate controversy, a legitimate scholarly debate, were the most distressing to me. That is, what's actually happened is, because of the resistance, because of the denial by the Turkish government and some academics in this country, most of whom have been systematically attacked by more serious scholars, the Turkish government has succeeded in rendering events which were not particularly controversial, that had been accepted as horrible events and eventually called a genocide, has rendered those events a controversy. That's a kind of success. And so Armenian scholars, after that, have had to backtrack and basically play or debate on the Turkish ground. That is, instead of doing serious scholarship about the genocide itself, many people have dedicated their careers to attempting to attack this denial campaign, which is quite systematic. Now, in fact, there can be debates and controversies in scholarship which are very unbalanced. That is, even the Holocaust, there are people who deny the Holocaust. Fortunately for the Holocaust, those people are considered crackpots, even though recently there was a court case against David Irving, which cost millions of dollars for the woman who was contending with him. But that's not considered particularly controversial. Let me tell you something that happened at Microsoft. After they contacted Helen Fine and they asked her to change her article, they wrote, the text they wanted her to use was, there are scholars who debate the Armenian genocide, it's a controversy, etc. The very next sentence said, however, there is no such controversy over the Holocaust. Well, this is a particularly damning sentence, because what it does is legitimize the Holocaust, fair enough, a horrible, terrible event. Everyone recognized that. But render the Armenian genocide a parallel event, illegitimate in a way, controversial. And of course, Dr. Fine refused to do that, appropriately so. Now, the outcome of all of this was eventually that Microsoft understood that they can't do this kind of revision. They can't both hire people to do scholarly work for them and then seriously question their, in a sense, their credentials, their legitimacy, their knowledge, etc. So eventually they backed down. But in the meantime, this idea that, well, maybe this event is questionable, maybe in fact the killing of hundreds of thousands or perhaps a million people shouldn't be called a genocide, that's going out into the public. And I've heard even people in universities say, well, what's going on here? They ask me, isn't this in fact a controversial event? And we have to start all over from the beginning.
Professor Ronald Suny, political science teacher at the University of Chicago, authored the piece for the Encarta Encyclopedia on the Armenian genocide. Just for listeners who didn't hear yesterday the program, in the end, you did change the wording somewhat of the piece after Microsoft, told you that if you didn't change it, they could take your name off the piece and put out whatever they wanted, change it.
That's right. I was surprised that Mr. Ault also denied that happened, you know, that he must be, in effect, sort of admitted in his own remarks that, in fact, they could do that, but they generally don't do that. But I said, you know, I specifically asked the editor, I said, what if I don't agree to this? And he said, well, then we remove your name and we publish it as we want, which I saw as a kind of threat and me losing control of my own words. What I actually wrote eventually was something like this. I won't read you the whole entry, but just a bit of it. The worst atrocities against Armenians occurred in the Ottoman Empire during World War II, when widespread deportations and massacres eliminated 90% of the Armenians in Anatolia, present-day Asian Turkey. Hundreds of thousands of Armenians were uprooted from their homelands in Anatolia and exiled to the deserts of present-day Syria. Many Armenians perished from starvation and disease or were killed by soldiers or civilians during the forced marches. By the time World War I ended, more than 800,000 Armenians had died. According to most historians, the Ottoman treatment of its Armenian subjects constituted the first great genocide of the 20th century. However, the present-day government of Turkey disputes the characterization of these events as genocide, arguing that the deaths were the result of civil war, disease, and famine. There I was trying to convey that, you know, among most historians, most people who look at this event, there's no question about what the event is. But then there is this campaign of denial, and some people have participated, some scholars, I put always scholars, these scholars in quotation marks, have participated in this kind of cover-up of the real essence of this event.
I wanted to read an article really from, I think it was 10 years ago in the Hartford Courant, March 25th, 1990, which takes the Armenian genocide and basically puts it into the year 2000 presidential election context. It's a piece by a professor at the University of Connecticut, Hartford, the University of Hartford, called Lieberman's Shame: To Remember One Holocaust But Forget Another. Again, written by Harold Abramson, professor of sociology at the University of Connecticut. And it says, U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman has helped to destroy the Senate resolution that would have designated April 24th as a national day of remembrance of the 75th anniversary of the Armenian genocide of 1915-1923. He justified his behavior by saying that, quote, the passage of the resolution would not change what happened decades ago. Abramson goes on to write in his editorial, the senator is shameless. Some of the criticism he has already received considers him amoral or charges him with Václav Havel's phrase, reprehensible passivity. The amorality accusation suggests that he does not know the difference between right and wrong, between what is just and unjust. Does the senator know and recognize his hypocrisy? Does he understand what is just and right? The fact that he can trample on the pain and memory of survivors and their children by saying passage of the resolution would not change what happened decades ago suggests strongly that the charge of amorality is on the mark. The charge of passivity is just as interesting, given the revolutionary changes in the world today that Havel's election as president of Czechoslovakia represents. But Lieberman hasn't always been passive. In fact, in his first Senate year, he's been quite active and authored or supported a number of Senate resolutions. For example, there was a resolution commemorating the 50th anniversary of the United States Jewish Appeal on May 2, 1989. It was good that the senator did not reject the memory of the victims of Nazism, even if the resolution could not undo the Holocaust. Then there was his vote for the resolution that would designate the week of May 7, 1989 as Jewish Heritage Week. That was another just decision because of the American recognition of an ancient religion and civilization. This resolution obviously could not change anything, but it could honor a heritage with all of its components, the survival and the sorrow. And he goes on from there. What about that, Professor Ronald Suny?
Well, that is a very strong and very powerful statement there. And it's clear that even very well-meaning politicians who take moral stands, you know, on Clinton's behavior, let's say, like as Lieberman did, or the Holocaust and so forth, somehow manage to trim their moral stance when it comes to this event because of the costs. Basically, what we're talking about here is the United States government has a very strong ally in the Republic of Turkey, a member of NATO. a republic that was important in the Gulf War, that was important in the Cold War actions against the Soviet Union. And they don't want to compromise that relationship. And when they do even hint that they might change their views on the Armenian genocide and officially declare that this event occurred and was a genocide, the Turks react with vehemence and anger. So this is realpolitik on one hand against the kind of moral stance on the other. And clearly, Lieberman, who's made some very nice statements, very powerful statements, recognizing the Armenian genocide in the Senate, will not take that last step and vote for this resolution, at least in 1990 that seems to have been the case. Let me mention something else while we're talking about this event, because politics, you know, have this unfortunate habit of shifting and changing, and the reality of the world changes too. And we're in a moment now in which the conditions in Turkey's attitude toward the rest of the world is also shifting. I would say this is a moment of political opening that Armenians, Turks, and politicians like Lieberman and Gore and others will have to face. What's happening in Turkey now is a new president has been elected. The Kurdish war at the moment is at a standstill. Turkey is very interested in getting into Europe. And many Turkish intellectuals at this point want to reevaluate some of the harsh and obviously distorted stands on history that their government has forced them to take. Recently in March, at the University of Chicago, we organized a conference. I'm sure it was the first ever in history in which we brought distinguished Armenian, Turkish, and other scholars together to discuss the end of the Ottoman Empire and the Armenian genocide. Now, this event was so controversial that some of the most distinguished Armenian scholars of the genocide refused to come. And, of course, some Turks, too, decided very quietly that they would not come. But we gathered a group of people. We had 3 days of incredibly interesting and scholarly, objective discussion. And at the end, 4 out of 5 of the Turkish scholars from Turkey itself freely used the word genocide. So for them, there was no controversy. They were appalled by their government's stand. They were ready to engage in a dialogue with Armenians and others about these events if it was done as a real scholarly dialogue, not as a kind of polemical, crossfire. So it seems to me that we are really at a moment where things are changing, that Armenians and Turks don't have to sit and spin in their wheels now for yet another generation over about who did what and why. Now we can begin to discuss this as scholars and find out the facts from both sides, because it's the Turkish scholars who will have the greater access, ease of entry into their own archives, and who can add to our understanding of what happened in 1915.
Professor Ronald Suny of the University of Chicago authored a piece in the Encart Encyclopedia on the Armenian genocide. I think it's very important to bring the story or how the Armenian genocide is dealt with in today's history books and writings, to bring it up to today and see how Turkey is dealt with and how it deals with the Kurds. I mean, just hours before Al Gore gave his acceptance speech on the floor of the Democratic National Convention, the U.S. and British planes bombed Iraq. On that same day, Turkey bombed northern Iraq, bombed the Kurds, and yet there is almost no mention of this. And Turkey's overall treatment of the Kurds, the killing of what in the last decade or 6 years, something like 46,000 Kurds, is rarely raised, perhaps because Turkey is an ally of the United States.
That's right. Turkey's at the moment a very unsavory ally, but it's one in which the United States is quite intimately tied. And so issues like the Armenian genocide, complaints of the Greeks toward Turkey's actions towards Cyprus, the treatment of Kurds, all of these things are swept under the rug. I remember some years ago I was at a Republican senator's gathering and was trying to explain to a very senior Republican senator, the complexities of the Kurdish question and how duplicitous has been American action in the area. That is, on one side of the border, we protect the Iraqi Kurds against the atrocities of Saddam Hussein. On the other side, we allow the Turks free rein, indeed use of our own weapons, against their own Kurds. Of course, all of these
and
things...
Of course, the Iraqi Kurds were not protected by the United States ultimately. Certainly, George Bush abandoned them.
At one point, but we have a kind of protection at the moment. We don't allow Saddam Hussein to fly over Kurdistan and so forth at the moment.
Well, many would argue in that case it has nothing to do with the Kurds, but just continually pummeling Saddam Hussein.
That's probably right. Again, realpolitik takes place over morality. From the Armenian side, from the side of a historian and a political scientist, what's important is that these issues be somehow decoupled from state policy so that they can be examined in their historical complexity. That is not allowed to happen. The Turkish government won't let that happen. Indeed, the American government, because of its refusal to recognize the Armenian genocide itself, allows this event to go on, to fester as if it were a legitimate controversy, rather than something that, for most historians, has been settled.
Professor Ronald Suni, I want to thank you for being with us, Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago. When we return, thank you, we are going to talk to two survivors of that genocide, or survivors of family members who either survived or did not what happened at in World War I. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Again, I wanted to go back to Joseph Lieberman, a senator in 1990s, comments when he, as Professor Abramson put it, a sociologist at the University of Connecticut, Hartford, said Lieberman helped to destroy the Senate resolution that would have designated April 24th as a National Day of Remembrance of the 75th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide of 1915-23. He justified his behavior by saying that the, quote, passage of the resolution would not change what happened decades ago. Professor Abramson goes on to say at the end of his piece in the Hartford Courant, Lieberman is insensible to the kinship of pain. He owes an apology and more to the Armenian community and the people of Connecticut. In his public statement, he explained that, quote, our efforts to memorialize the Armenian people and their suffering do not take place in a vacuum. Of course, neither justice nor evil occurs in a vacuum, Abramson writes, and there are always expedient arguments for the pursuit of evil and the denial of justice. We're joined now by Thea Halo, who's author of the book, Not Even My Name, From a Death March in Turkey to a New Home in America, A Young Girl's True Story of Genocide and Survival, as well as Peter Balakian, author of the memoir Black Dog of Fate, An American Son Uncovers His Armenian Past. He is professor of humanities at Colgate University in New York. Peter Balakian, your response?
Well, you know, I think that the issue of historical memory is very much a part of the legacy, and in the tragic case of the Turkish government's denial, the legacy of genocide, because as genocide scholars universally underscore, the denial of genocide is the final stage of genocide, and it seeks to demonize the victims and rehabilitate the perpetrators. And, of course, it sends the message that genocide doesn't matter, that it demands no moral response. I think the whole issue of denial, in some sense, does a kind of enormous continuance of the genocidal process in that it strives, the perpetrator culture and its legacy strive to create a counterfeit universe for everyone, and that counterfeit universe particularly robs the survivor culture, at least attempts to rob the survival culture of their moral universe, of their moral order.
The estimates again of how many Armenians died in that period, 1915 to 23.
I think the best estimates take us to about 1.2 to 1.3 million. The lowest estimates are a little below a million. The highest, a little over 1.5 million. Most genocide historians come in at 1.2 to 1.3 million.
The subtitle of your book, An American Son Uncovers His Armenian Past. How did you uncover it?
Well, my journey, in my memoir really deals with, at once, a kid growing up in the suburban, affluent world of 1950s, 1960s, northern New Jersey, Teaneck and Tenafly, New Jersey, and coming from a family that couldn't speak openly about the Armenian Genocide past because it had so traumatized them. And yet, even though they couldn't speak openly, there was constant leakage. And so I would receive as a kid what I came to think of and call encoded traumas, encoded messages about this horrible, tragic experience that had preceded me. And then in my adult life, I came to read history and learn the narrative that my family could never tell me. One of the most important texts for me in discovering the Armenian Genocide was the memoir by Ambassador Henry Morgenthau, the American Jew who was the ambassador to Turkey between 1913 and 1916, the years during which the genocide happened. And Morgenthau has several extraordinary chapters in his memoir, Ambassador Morgenthau's Story. This was published in the United States by Doubleday in 1918. His chapter, The Murder of a Nation, is one of the most powerful accounts of the Armenian Genocide. And I want to emphasize that the genocide in its day, in the teens, was the largest international human rights issue in the world. It was the first major international human rights campaign for the United States to get involved in. And the U.S. got involved in the Armenian genocide issue as far back as 1894, when the Sultan Abdulhamid II began his waves of massacre that took the lives of almost 300,000 Armenians. So that the Armenian bloodshed begins in the 90s, and Americans are immersed in it. And Morgenthau is one of the great men of conscience in American history. And his memoir, of course, is based on the thousands and thousands of pages of eyewitness reporting from his consular staff in the interior of Turkey. Men like Leslie Davis in Harpert and Jesse Jackson in Aleppo, Oscar Heiser in Trebizond, Edward Nathan in Marash, and so on. I mean, these men are giving Morgenthau almost weekly dispatches on what is so obvious from the start is a systematic, planned, government-organized campaign for race extermination.
I don't know if you'd have a U.S. ambassador to Turkey today doing any kind of exposés like we saw then around the modern-day Kurds.
I don't think we would. I think as Americans, we want to look back at these men with enormous admiration for their courage, for their ethics, and for their very good prose. When you read these, accounts, it's very moving.
Professor Balakian, I wanted to bring Thea Halo into the conversation. Her book, Not Even My Name, From a Death March in Turkey to a New Home in America, A Young Girl's True Story of Genocide and Survival. Thea Halo, this is the story of your mother, and it expands the Armenian genocide to other groups of people. Can you explain?
Yes, my mother was a Pontic Greek from Turkey also, and the Greeks were in Turkey for, or rather in Asia Minor, for over 3,000 years. There were three groups of Greeks in Turkey. That was the Pontians, who lived along the northern coast of the Black, or the southern coast of the Black Sea and the Pontic Mountains; the Ionian Greeks, who lived along the western shores where Smyrna is; and the Cappadocian Greeks, who lived in central Turkey. My father was an Assyrian, and no one ever mentions that the Assyrians and the Greeks of Turkey were also both slaughtered. The Assyrian people, like the Armenian people, mainly lived along the eastern coast of Turkey and the southern portion of Turkey. And the campaign against the Christians, the Assyrians are also a traditionally Christian people that go back as far back as the other Christians began to adopt Christianity in the early part of the third century. They were also slaughtered wholesale. I think they claimed that there were 750,000 Assyrians killed during that period. My mother was marched in 1920 from the Pontic Mountains of the north all the way through the desert lands of the south. Obviously, they were heading them towards to the Syrian desert, as they had the Armenians and the Assyrians before them. Below Diyarbakir, my mother's family finally escaped from the Turkish soldiers, and they went back to a place called Karabash, which was south of Diyarbakir. But their money by that time was gone, and they were really destitute. My mother was then finally, to save her life, her mother gave her away to a woman in a very, very small village.
When her mother and she were on a death march.
Yes, they marched for something like 7 to 8 months. And when we think that they were close to the borders of the Black Sea, they could have been transported. If it was a question of transporting Greeks out of the area, they could have transported them from the coast. Instead, they marched them. There were some documents from the German and Austrian ambassadors saying that these death marches, when they talk about exile, that exile was synonymous with genocide, because whoever wasn't slaughtered on the way died of disease and starvation and exposure. And they knew perfectly well that that was going to happen. There's also archival information in my book, Not Even My Name, beginning with from 1909, from the German ambassador in Athens, Wengenheim, to Chancellor Bulo, quoting the Turkish Prime Minister Sefker Pasha: "The Turks have decided upon a war of extermination against their Christian subjects." That was in 1909. Oftentimes we hear that people, the Turkish government or apologists for the Turkish government, say that this was just a consequence of the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. But obviously this was all very, very planned, much before even the war.
Peter Balakian mentioned the encoded messages he got when he was growing up, never the real story, narrative of the Armenian genocide. What about you? Did you understand what happened when you were a little girl to your family, to your mother and others?
Well, fortunately for us, my mother, of course, as a child, she told us sort of general things. We knew that they had been on a death march. We knew that she lost everyone. We knew that her little sister, who was 3 years old at the time, actually died in her arms, and she didn't realize what was happening. We knew some of those things, but we really didn't know all the details. But my mother said that she made a point of remembering, because she didn't want her people to die. And so fortunately for me, in 1989, I took her back to Turkey to see if we can find her home 70 years after her exile, and I memorialize this in the book. And it was then that I stood on her land that I finally felt connected to my heritage. Before that, it was her story and her people. When I stood on that land, they became, for the first time in my life, my people. And then I began to ask her very specifically what happened, and I began to take down her story.
The point where her mother leaves her in order to save her, could you read that from your book? We're talking to Thea Halo. Her book is Not Even My Name, From a Death March in Turkey to a New Home in America, Young Girl's True Story of Genocide and Survival.
When they knocked on one of the doors in a little mud village, the woman said, "This one, she's so pretty, why don't you just give this one to me and I'll take care of her?" And at first her mother said, "No, I can't do that. because she doesn't belong to me. And my mother asked, why did you say that? And she said, because I couldn't bear to let you go. And I'll start reading from there. Then she stopped walking and looked into my face. Tears crept into her eyes, and she threw her arms around me and held me to her breast. I couldn't bear to give you away, she said. She held me tightly for some moments before letting me go. I could feel her chest heaving uncontrollably. She held my face against her breast so I couldn't see her tears, but they fell on my head and cheek like crystallized drops of desert rain. When the sun was low in the sky, Mother sat down on a stone and spread her apron to reveal the food she had gathered for the day. It was barely enough for two, let alone six. She stared down at it for a long time as if willing it to multiply. Then she closed her eyes and began to sob. Maybe you should go stay with that woman for a while, she said. She'll feed you and then you'll be safe, and I can come back to see you. All right, I said. I don't remember a time when I said no to my mother. Have you decided to leave her then? The woman asked in Turkish when she opened the door. Yes, Mother said, if you promise to take good care of her. Of course, the woman said. Mother turned to me. I will visit you, she said. You must remember how much I love you, how much I love all of you. She wrapped her arms around me and pulled me close, tucking my head between her breasts and kissing me on top of my head over and over again. She held me so tightly I could barely take a breath, but I melted into her until I couldn't tell where she ended and I began. When she let go, she took the belt she had woven from around her own waist and wrapped it around mine. Again she pulled me to her breast and held me tight, imprinting my own image onto her body. Again she let go and this time walked away without looking back. I stood with the woman in the doorway of her home watching my mother walk away. Even when the woman went into her home, I still stood there watching my mother grow smaller and smaller until she was no more than a tiny line on the horizon that turned to vapor and disappeared in the waves of heat rising from the ground.
And that little girl was your mother.
Was my mother, yes.
And what happened after that?
Well, the woman had promised to take good care of my mother, but she became very cruel. And when she heard that my mother's mother, my grandmother, had died soon after, she then changed her name. She said she could never pronounce her name, and so she changed her name from Thamia, which was a Greek name, to Sana, which was a Kurdish name. And that really robbed my mother of the last vestige of her history and her connection to her people.
And so she ran away?
She stayed with that woman for about 2 years. She was only 10 when my mother was left. And she stayed with her. She tried to run away a few times. Once her brother, the woman's brother, brought her back. But when she was 12, she ran away for good. And she ran all the way to Diyarbakir, not knowing where she would go. She had met a woman once in that woman's house. And she went to look for her.
And ultimately came to the United States and had her family.
From my father, yes.
And that's how you got her name, the name of your book, Not Even My Name.
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us as we continue this discussion of stories untold throughout the world. Not Even My Name, From a Death March in Turkey to a New Home in America, a Young Girl's True Story of Genocide and Survival, is published by Picador Press. And Peter Balakian's book, Black Dog of Fate, An American Son Uncovers His Armenian Past. I want to thank you both for being with us, and also encourage people to call in to tell their stories. You can leave a message at 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. You can also write to us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, call 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill with help from Deepa Fernandez. Matthew Finch is our engineer. Errol Maitland's our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!